Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
The only thing that's ever changed the world are individuals who believe it can happen.
One of the easiest and quickest victories you can obtain in India in any kind of activism on women's issues is a nice law. It's very easy to get a nice law. The much harder part is in getting any kind of real implementation.
I do see it in a lot of girls that I meet. For you to think that your life is all depending on finding a man that's going to make you happy, this needs to change. And I believe the only change that this actually could happen is by more education.
Welcome to the Guardian Global Development Podcast, which this month is asking the question, are women's rights movements the force for change? First of all, let's hear how women's rights movements have changed over the years from Sahila Nazneen, an academic from Bangalore, whose book, Voicing Demands, about feminist activism, has recently been released.
If you look at the second wave of feminist movement, which is basically from 1960s, 1970s, women were able to raise issues around economic justice, around political rights, around social issues, not just in the West, but also in the developing country context. So they did advance in terms of, if you look at policy gains around violence against women, around economic rights, like in terms of labor rights, there were advancements. And it just seemed like things were really growing great in the 1990s when the Cold War ended. And you also had Beijing, the UN Fourth Women's Conference. And that created a lot of space and created space for engagement with the state particularly. But by the time we entered this new millennium with 9/11, with the political context changing, with increased democratization, you had more competition from other groups. Other demands came up. So you had to clamor to get your voices heard. You had the rise of the conservative groups in the political scene, which created a particular type of challenge. You had, in a way, what we call professionalization of women's movement, which is basically with increased, not just increased donor funding, but also entering the policy spaces. You needed to know how to speak a certain kind of language, to place your demands in a certain kind of way, and to package it in a particular manner, which the women's movement did very successfully. But that also meant exclusion of certain agenda, fitting your agenda and packaging it in a particular way. You were packaging things that would fit within the development agenda.
So do you think that the women's movement has actually almost like got weaker recently?
I wouldn't say it's weaker. I would say that if you look at even the larger sort of studies, which does very rigorous quantitative stuff, to look at who pushes the agenda through for women, it is still women's movement, particularly on issues that we call transformative issues. So issues that would challenge your established gender norms. So for example, laws around abortion, laws around violence against women, or laws around property rights, key issues for women to attain gender equity. And I mean, that's where women's movement plays a key role. It still does. So in that sense, no, it hasn't weakened. It's a challenging scenario. And the other challenges that women's movement is facing is, one is around building intergenerational movements. So we have done quite well. But if you look at the feminist groups and who are the members within the feminist groups, you do find young people, but not as in larger numbers as you would see, let's say, in environmental movements or anti-corruption movements.
So Sahila believes that getting more young people engaged on the issue is a challenge. But how different are things for young protesters out on the streets today? I spoke to Srilatha Batliwala, a veteran of women's protests in India in the 1960s and 70s, and NG Hoslan, a student now based in London, who helped to set up the Harass Map project in Egypt. I began by asking Srilatha whether things had changed in India after the story from December 2012 of the Delhi student who was raped on a bus and later died of her injuries.
It was a time at which whenever something happened to women, whether it was street harassment or rape or dowry deaths or domestic violence, people would say, what is the women's movement doing about this? But on December 16th last year, And in the weeks after it, nobody said, what is the women's movement doing? The debate on the streets, on every corner, in every city was, what are we doing about it? And I think that sense of a much larger ownership of the whole way in which women are situated in society is a product of this kind of long-term struggle to get the media to report the issues differently, to get society to take ownership of this, to get people to reflect in communities on the norms that allow these kinds of things to happen.
It was interesting what you said, Relata, about more of an ownership now than there was 20, 30 years ago. So, Engie, how can you engage men on the issues in Egypt?
I would say that since the revolution or the uprising in 2011, men and women have been both alike engaged in the social action and the political mobilization that was happening. From day one, women and men were together protesting in the street, participating in sit-ins and in marches and organizing together as well. Whereas on the other hand, when some of the protests were women's issues specific, we had a high number of men engaging with the movement. And I would say that the viciousness of the recent attacks on women, whether the mob attacks that women experienced in Tahrir through the protests, have been enough of a reason to get men and women both to engage and volunteer to help stop it and work on it.
Do you think that feminist activism that occurred under Mubarak has actually helped the protests, or has it sort of hindered?
I would say definitely. I mean, many of the groups that exist today had already been working and challenging the Mubarak regime and resisting the authoritarian rule of and the dictatorship of the previous regime. So many of the feminist groups and the activist groups have been working for so long. They haven't just started 3 years ago. They've been working maybe for the last 10 or 15 years.
Shulata, if I can just bring you in, what do you think has changed for you over the years? And obviously, listening to what Engie's been saying, do you see any similarities in what she's doing?
The similarity lies in the fact that, like in Egypt, I think we've had a state that's been, in many ways, fakely supportive of women's issues. One of the easiest and quickest victories you can obtain in India in any kind of activism on women's issues is a nice law. It's very easy to get a nice law. The much harder battle, and that's where I draw the parallel with Egypt, is in getting any kind of real implementation or in getting the state to tackle, for instance, state-sponsored violence.
So what would you say has been your biggest success?
I think our biggest success is that we have shifted the public discourse and the public understanding on the violation of women's rights in a very fundamental way. The outpouring of anger and protest after last December 16th and the continuing debate in the media, in drawing rooms, on the streets, in buses, in colleges, in schools. I mean, I think we've finally made the issue of the position of women in Indian society a kind of much larger and more widely owned concern.
And Engie, can I bring you in there? How have you sort of engaged young people? And do you agree with the media changing slightly and how you report and information just getting out much quicker?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I definitely agree. And I can draw a lot of comparison similarities because of social media, there has been a lot of mobilization in Egypt. And I mean, of course, this has been said so many times, but the uprising in Egypt started as a Facebook event. And I remember telling my friend, are you really inviting me to an event that's called a revolution? And at the time, I was quite skeptical that social media would have that much influence on mobilization and collecting, bringing people together. But it has definitely, I've personally experienced how social media can gather people from all over Egypt.
Did the Delhi rape, just out of interest, did the Delhi rape have much of an impact in Egypt?
Well, it was quite discussed in Egypt, and especially among feminist groups. And I mean, we've always followed music protests and activism and mobilization in India. In fact, especially on the campaigns against sexual harassment, we've learned a lot from the Indian experiences, engaging the community and engaging grassroots. We definitely also drew parallels because of the gang assaults and the gang rapes that happened in Tahrir and in protests. Actually, one of the things that we're focusing on, and I'm personally focusing on, is the gang and mob assaults and how these are formed and how these are happening in an unorganized manner, and how a group of men could come together and decide that in this public place, whether in a bus like the Delhi rape or in the square like in Cairo, that they will rape this woman in the public and run away with it. With this mob mentality, thinking that an impunity, there's no punishment, they can run away with it.
I just wonder whether I could ask you both, maybe Sharlata first. Do you think that women's protest movements, can they still be a force for change today?
I would say yes. I mean, I agree with Inji that I think it's getting harder in some ways to organize and mobilize. I think there's a lot more backlash happening. Even in our country, we're seeing a lot more backlash than perhaps we saw at an earlier time. But I think there's no option. I think the women's movements have played a critical role, because if they hadn't, none of these issues would even be considered remarkable or worth remedying.
Yes, I agree. I completely agree. There's no other way. We have to continue. We have to continue challenging those patriarchal systems now that with every kind of regime that we get, whether it is religious-led, like the Muslim Brotherhood, or military-led, we've experienced in both cases extreme forms of patriarchy and misogyny. So I believe the situation will continue being challenging. The problem is that only each phase has its own different challenges.
Today, women are reaching positions of power. In Africa, for example, there are now 3 female heads of state. But does getting to a position of power help the grassroots women to make changes in their daily life? I asked Sahila again how to achieve that.
It's a tricky thing to do. So you may be very successful as a community leader and raising issues that and concerns that your community has. So for example, if you look at the anti-alcohol movements in Andhra Pradesh in India, so it started off as a local concern and women's concerns, because their men in the households were quite heavily drinking, spending all the money, getting quite violent. So it started as a local concern with the women getting together within in the community and then pushing the issue. But it got picked up by the larger community groups. Women learned how to speak. You know, it's not that they were not speaking, but how to speak at larger gatherings, to gain leadership qualities, and to raise not just issues around anti-alcohol, but also other concerns that they had. So it's a good training process, because as a politician, you need to have certain kind of skills. So that's what the women learned. We have been doing another research which looks at women's entry into mainstream politics, so women's sort of pathways into political power. And what we found is that basically, given that political parties are patriarchal, and given that in certain countries, like for example, if you look at Bangladesh or even India or many other developing countries, actually, because the pattern of politics is patronage-based and it's clientelist, so you need to have, and it's violent, so either you need muscle power or you need money, or you need family connections, which is why in South Asia you'd see dynastic politics so much. So you see women who are entering politics would have other family members who were engaged in politics.
How do women sort of negotiate or attain this space to participate, whether that's in their community level, in local leadership, or sort of in national government? I mean, I went to Sierra Leone, talked to some women groups in Sierra Leone, in Freetown, and they were saying, politics is violent. It's violent in this country. Women don't want to get involved. So how do you, encourage women to do that, but how can they negotiate it?
I think that's where we have gotten stuck, because we talk about that, okay, let's clean up politics. But how do you clean up politics where All the parties who are engaged in politics have that kind of vested interest to keep it violent and to have money play a big role because it sort of works in their benefit. So you can have, let's say, electoral laws around election spending, and you can cap it so that it's useful for women, that it works for women in terms of campaign costs. You can sort of have laws around which sort of lowers the registration fee for women when they're running for elections, which is what they did in Ghana, actually, which was a very interesting case that the parliament agreed to do that. But the parliament agreed to do that in exchange of not having a gender quota, which the political parties were against it. So you have all these trade-offs.
Have women's movements, do you think, become the force for change today?
Yes, definitely. It is critical for, as I was saying before, in terms of transformative issues, it is very, very critical. It's also critical for keeping women's issues on the agenda. We are doing another piece of research, which is also DFID funded, and this is run by different universities based in the South. And it looks at the issues around political settlement. So political settlement is just a fancy term to sort of talk about how your relations of power in a society, in a political order, is negotiated. So that's what it looks at. And so when you're renegotiating sort of your power in a society, so which is power in the sense that A, how you control violence, and B, in a society, and B, power in the sense that how you distribute resources. So a lot of bargaining takes place within the elite groups. And obviously, then there is a question about, are women part of the elite? Then that's where women's movement comes in. Because when you're negotiating, of course, those who are in power would want to negotiate in a particular way, but they would also take into cognizance that, are there groups that are quite influential who can disrupt your arrangement?
I caught up with a powerful African woman in London, Dr. Mamphele Ramphele, an experienced anti-apartheid activist who has been in the headlines more recently for her attempt to be the presidential candidate for the opposition Democrat Alliance Party in South Africa. So what does she think is the most important way to change things for women?
Women face hurdles of a world that is still being defined by men for men. It is a fundamental cultural problem that despite women being the majority, despite women having an influence in bringing up every human being on earth, we still have attitudes that confine women to certain traditional roles or treat them as oddities if they are not in those traditional roles. I have experienced this throughout my life. I've had to overcome those hurdles from the time when I announced that I wanted to become a doctor, and the pastor in our village said to me, "You can't be a doctor being a black woman." Even my own daughter, who is white, had to settle for being a nurse. How do you think you are going to be able to do it? But that left me even more determined to become that which I wanted to become.
How do you think women can negotiate spaces, whether it's in their family or at local level or in national politics, to actually advocate for their rights?
The best way of negotiating your way around these obstacles is first of all to know your strengths and play to them to the hilt. People could say whatever they liked, but they knew I would beat them at every academic game that they were to play. And that puts you in a strong position. Don't try and be the athlete. Don't try and be that which you are not. Play to your strengths.
Do you think quotas for women parliamentarians is a good thing?
I am not in favor of quotas in any form or shape. Women are the majority. They don't need quotas. What we need is to learn to have the confidence in ourselves and to mobilize strategically to express this majority, which is us. When you go the quota route, you are giving up on your majority status.
Do you see women's movements as a force for change? in locally, nationally, internationally, looking at all this thing that's been going on recently, Arab Spring, what do you think about women's movements?
Civic movements are the only thing that have changed the world. It starts with individual citizens changing the world, a la Margaret Mead. The only thing that's ever changed the world are individuals who believe it can happen. And women's movements, youth movements, are what that is about. The women's movement in South Africa is dead. It's been subsumed by party political linked entities like the Women's League, the ANC Women's League. They are not about women's rights. They are simply vehicles for women to have access to political power. But they are not the promoters of the kind of solidarity that women need to overcome this very systematic male dominance that is global.
That's all from the Guardian Global Development podcast this month. You can join the debate at theguardian.com/globaldevelopment. I'm Liz Ford, and the producer was Celeste Hicks.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.